Well, welcome everybody. We'll go through, we'll have some fun, and we're going to go over some questions that you would see on board exams in HIV. So, welcome, and today we're playing This is HIV Jeopardy. All right? And our categories are Can't We All Just Get Along? Board of the Boards, HIV Style. And I'm okay, you're going to be okay. So, just like on Real Jeopardy, let's see, we'll have ladies go first. Sheila, you get to pick a category.
I'm okay, you're
going to
be okay.
For how much?
20.
Okay, the first one to buzz in on this is gonna win it, so we've got to go for 20.
Do you really get the money or no?
Oh, here we go. I have better than money. The Max study. Remember, you have to answer in the form of a question. The Max study. Anybody? Anybody? Anybody want to venture a guess? Oh, I hear something. Dr. Testori, it sounded like a rattle to me. Okay. Let me tell you what the Max study was. Anybody know? Anybody want to guess? The Max study actually was a study done in several different cities in the United States, 11 different cities. And what it actually showed was that viral load was prognostic. So the answer is, what is the study that showed viral load is prognostic? And what they actually did was they looked at different CD4 counts. Oh, let me get my laser pointer here. They looked at different CD4 counts. Shown up here. And I gave Michael all the slides, so anybody wants these slides, you have them. So here's 0 to 200, here's 200 to 350, here's 350 to 500, and here's greater than 500. Now this study was done towards the end of the 80s, early 90s, and it's been ongoing since. So there was really no medications to treat folks, but there was viral load assay developed. And so they then actually looked by viral load, and that's what the different Roman numerals mean. Viral load less than 500, 500 to 3,000, 3,000 to 10,000, and 10,000 to 30,000, and higher than 30,000, to see how actually patients did in terms of AIDS-free survival. So, for instance, if you had viral load of, say 10,000 to 30,000, your T cells when you entered the study were between 0 to 200. The proportion AIDS-free at 8 years after measurement was already less than 0.2. So that's how it did. And what you saw actually here, so let's look at a higher CD4, say greater than 500. If you had a low viral load and a high CD4 when you entered the study, those patients actually that were AIDS-free all the way out at 8, 10 years was still pretty high. But if you had a low viral load, despite entering the study with a high CD4, you progress much faster. And while this seems sort of real, you know, something that you would know right now, back then it was really sort of earth-changing. It really changed the whole way we approached HIV and how actually we monitored disease progression. And you got to remember, when this study started, there was really not much in terms of medications. What we have found out since, of course, is that if you put people on medications and drive down their viral load, you're able to increase their overall quality of life, their overall survival, their overall AIDS-free progression. Just a reminder, I know I showed this slide last time I talked to you guys. What happens soon after HIV infection? Well, your CD4 count, which usually starts out around 1,000, slowly declines, and usually after about 10 years, then the average person with HIV then starts to go down rapidly. And then we start seeing people hitting T cells of 200 or less. And also shown on here is, you don't have to know about all the different antibodies that are made, except the important thing to know is that for the first 6 weeks after HIV infection, you may not actually have an antibody response. So that's called the window period. So if someone actually came in and had an acute viral syndrome, they may just have a rash. If you did antibody testing with any of the antibody kits, whether the rapid or the conventional ELISA kits, it may not show up positive yet. So there you'd want to do is, and people can win some money here if I hear anyone buzz in, anybody want to say what you would do if you had somebody with acute antiviral syndrome? What kind of test would you do? P24, that's a good one. And what else? Okay, all right. So You're going to have to look out. If I hit somebody, I apologize. So here we go. Ready? There you go. Go ahead. That's why I said you got to sit close. You got to sit close. All right. You got to sit close or it's not that good a shot. All right. So, and then this actually looks at actually what happens with different CD4s and different viral loads. So it looks like a very complicated graph, but actually what it breaks down to is this is the pre-heart error and this is the post-heart error. And so what you see actually in this last column is if you had CD4, you should be less than 200. And the highest viral load, 55,000, those patients actually who went on to a three-year probability of AIDS was the highest. And the lowest group was the ones that had the highest CD4 and the lowest viral load. Now, in the post-heart error, where we actually now have antivirals that are very effective, even this group here, which really progressed to AIDS in 3 years, now has a much less chance of having that happen. Okay? So that's the MAC study and some of the other things that go along with it. Now I just got to get my pointer back. My pointer was okay. Oop, let me go back. Oh, here we go. Okay. All right, we're back to our board. So since no one got it here, Leonard, you get to steal the board. Oh, I lost my pointer again. I hope this is not going to... Whoops, let's go back. I know you know the answer to that one. Oh, this worked. How about if I... Oh, I'm giving away all the answers here. Oh, there we go. Okay. So, sorry, board of the boards. For how much?
20.
For 20, okay. The most appropriate treatment for a 21-year-old HIV-positive female with progressive shortness of breath and a dry, non-productive cough of 3 weeks duration with a low-grade fever. We're looking for the most appropriate treatment. She tested positive 7 years ago. She's not seen a doc since. She's not taking any medications. Her physical exam shows she's mildly distressed. She has a respiratory rate of 28. Her blood pressure is 126 over 76. Her heart rate's 100. Her temperature's 101. Chest exam reveals crackles in bilateral lower lung fields. Chest x-ray is remarkable for diffuse bilateral interstitial infiltrates, and she has a butterfly pattern. Laboratory studies, ABG on room air, 747-32. Oh, I hear someone buzzing in. No, I'm sorry, that's not the right answer. Bactrim and steroids, this guy wins. This guy wins. Yes, we do. What is the AA gradient? Who wants to win some extra prizes? What's the AA gradient? Who wants to buzz in? Here. What's the AA gradient for this patient? Anybody want to say? How do we calculate it? 150 minus PO2, which is 72, plus 32 divided by 0.8. Yeah. Okay, so that would be 40. 32 over 0.8 is 40. Plus 72 is 112. 150 minus 112 is about 38. So, when do we start steroids? 35 and also PO2 less than?
60.
All right. She answered in the form of a question. She wins. So, all right. So, what is add steroids to Bactrim? That's the answer. The patient most likely has PCP. In mild cases, the clinical exam may be normal. Characteristic chest x-ray shows bilateral diffuse interstitial infiltrates. CT the chest will show ground glass. First line treatment is Bactrim with corticosteroids added if the PO2 is less than 70, hers was 72, and her AA gradient is greater than 35, which she just barely made. That's why I made it a little bit tricky. Okay? That's classic PCP, and this is sort of a, if you were to get a board's question, this is pretty simple, but one that may ask, okay? All right, you got the, right, you get to pick. 40 for board of the boards? All right. The most appropriate evaluation for a 38-year-old homeless female who presents with severe odontophagia and mild dysphagia of 7 days duration. She cannot eat solid food. She can only drink cold ginger ale and ice water. The patient has a history of IDU and chronic hepatitis C. She is not certain whether she was ever tested for HIV. Her exam is unremarkable except for mild dehydration. She has no oral or cutaneous lesions. She has a normocytic anemia and mild leukopenia with lymphopenia. We're looking for the most appropriate evaluation. Oh, you got an answer. EGD? No. Oh, boy, she's cleaning up. Someone's going to have to give that woman insulin. So, HIV-associated candida esophagitis is the most likely diagnosis, and empiric treatment with fluconazole is the most cost-effective approach. This was actually an Annals paper years ago, and this is really, and this is kind of a question you might ask on the boards. So you would do is empiric, and you guys do this all the time, empiric fluconazole, you'll see if there's response. She doesn't know her HIV status, so we're going to do a rapid test. We're going to do is confirmatory Western blot if that's positive. We'll probably send off a CD4 and viral load. Much less common, but probably second on your differential, is herpetic esophagitis. And there you would think about empiric valacyclovir. Barium swallow studies have low sensitivity and specificity for candida esophagitis. Although upper endoscopy is highly sensitive and specific, it is an expensive and potentially dangerous approach. So we would reserve that for patients that really didn't respond to diflucan, fluconazole, or valacyclovir. So empiric therapy with fluconazole is the most appropriate therapy for a patient with suspected HIV-associated candida esophagitis. Okay, question I have for you, but this is, you don't get any candy for this one. Candida esophagitis, AIDS-defining or not?
Yes.
Oral thrush, AIDS-defining or not? No. Okay, good, Aaron. No, but she had dysphagia and odontophagia and homeless. I mean, I'm sure some of the folks here have been on wards. We've had some times where we had that, but it's not common. Usually you will see some oral thrush too. Okay? Say again? Before starting the fluconazole? No, not necessarily. You could start the fluconazole, and could still be immunosuppressed for non-HIV reasons. But you would send, I mean, you definitely, in this case, would send off HIV tests. So. Okay. Dr. Tessitore.
Okay.
$60. Oh. And you get the video daily double. All right. Unfortunately, the audio doesn't work. I had audio for these things too, but all right. Okay. The best treatment, and since she got the video daily double, she gets first crack at this one. The best treatment of this 31-year-old HIV-positive male came to your office with the appearance of numerous pinpoint purplish to bright red ray spots and nodules up to 10 centimeters on or just under the skin. He also had high fever, tender and swollen lymph nodes, nausea, vomiting, sweats, chills, and poor appetite. What is the best treatment?
Heart.
Okay, nope, nobody's getting candy for that. That's always the best treatment, but this case is actually a more specific treatment, I would say, that's probably better. Anybody want to guess what this is? What? Kaposi's, okay. No candy for you. This is actually, but it's a good thought. And this is really a differential. This is something that you guys don't see too much of now, but we used to see a lot of it. Oh! A little late. I think Aaron owes the rest of the group candy. What is erythromycin or doxycycline first line? If either antibiotic is not tolerated, use tetracycline or clarithro or azithro. So this is bacillary angiomatosis, and that's what it is. The differential is KS, and it's hard to distinguish a lot of times between them. KS tends to be more symmetric and swarming. KS is caused by a? You guys know that. Yes, HHV, HHV. Bartonella, of course, is not HHV. It's a result of flea-infested cats. It causes other things like body louse. Now it occurs mainly in AIDS patients. It may also be from other immunocompromised diseases. Infection can cause blood vessels to grow out of control and form tumor-like masses. The diagnosis of cutaneous BA remains biopsy with histopath study. It responds very readily, though, to macrolides and to tetracycline and doxycycline and erythritol. Okay? KS is a cancer of the blood vessels, HHV-8. May develop at any time during the course of HIV, but usually it's less than 200. And KS is an AIDS-defining illness. Okay? KS presents as red to purple spots, macules, and raised bumps. It's first seen on the skin, commonly on the legs and feet. They can occur in the mouth. We've seen them in the lungs. We've seen them in the gut. We've seen them everywhere, right? Has anybody here seen KS in patients on the wards? A few times, right? We used to see tons of it. Now we see less of it, but every now and then we'll see one of it. We had a young guy, Leonard, when we were on, had it in the mouth. Was he yours, Jolina? Yeah, 24-year-old guy. So we do see it now and then. KS can occur also internally, gut, lungs, genitals, and lymphatic systems. Usually when that happens, that's a bad prognosis, though. The patients are usually very advanced. They often are really in bad shape. You can treat KS with chemo. I'm going to skip through a lot of this stuff because of time. Cryotherapy, radiation, surgical removal. KS is very respondent to heart. So that's a patient who you really do want to start hard on, and that really will help a lot. So this is actually slides mixed in. What we see here actually is these are all KS, except for this guy. But everybody else here is KS. And it tends to be the symmetric lesion swarming both sides. You see, see the kind of distribution. What's that? What's this guy over here? Basilar angiomatosis. That's the one guy who had basilar angiomatosis. KS sometimes is these raised red violaceous papules. Other times it can be even stalk-like. They're very similar. It's very hard to distinguish except with the biopsy.
Is it usually
that disseminated? Basilar angiomatosis? I haven't seen a case in a while, but usually it can be quite disseminated. You really can see it everywhere. I mean, KS too. You can catch it early, you see it only localized, but it can really swarm everywhere. You know, when we didn't have antiretrovirals, you would just see the late manifestations of both of these, so... Okay. Aaron, since you brought it up last, you get to pick.
I'm going to be okay.
I'm okay. You're okay for?
I'm okay. You're going to be okay.
For 40? Okay. What is... Oh, I blew this question. We'll go on. I'll have to give you another one. The answer was, what is the new recommendations for treatment options for first-line naive patients? And this just changed. This was the latest guidelines that came out in November 2008. What happens is usually like around once or twice a year, they get together these experts, they give them a lot of wine and beer and some fancy hotel rooms, and then they come up with new guidelines. So what they said actually was, and what the key change here was, there is now only one actually medication recommended for NRTI options. So if you guys remember the different categories of HIV treatment, the most basic ones are NRTIs, nucleoside inhibitors, non-nucleoside inhibitors, and protease inhibitors. Now, there's some other new drugs that have come out in some other classes, but those are sort of our tried and true ones that we usually pick from in terms of medications. There's integrase inhibitors now, infusion inhibitors, and other things, but that's sort of our basic groups. It used to be, and somebody can win a prize here, in addition to this one, which is a combination pill now available as Truvada, there was another medicine that was an NRTI option for first line. Oh!
That was
No!
Oh, well,
that was a long time ago. That was four hotel rooms and three drunken brawls before. No. What was the last one? No, that's protease inhibitor. No, that's efavirenz. It was actually Epsicom, which is abacavir and lamivudine in one pill. Abacavir and lamivudine in one pill. So that got bumped. And the reason that got bumped was there was two major studies that came out that bumped it down. And there's a little controversy about it being bumped off the list. But there was a study where actually it showed that maybe there was more cardiovascular events that occurred with this. And Fuad is our expert on that study. Anybody afterwards can ask him questions about it, and he'll be happy to give you candy for asking him. So that bumped it down. And then also what was important is they do these AIDS clinical trial groups, which is they randomize patients to different arms of studies. They're usually robust. They're usually done, you know, really very well set up protocols. And in the one that I actually looked at, actually, Truvada versus Epsicom, with a few other modifications to it, the Epsicom arm didn't perform well for folks that had high viral loads, higher than 100,000. And they stopped the study prematurely. And that really sort of factored into this being bumped off of the preferred options for first line. Now, in terms of drugs that are put with it, now it comes down to efavirenz. And so there's a combined pill of these with these. And anybody can win candy if they know the combined pill name. Atripla, who said that? All right. Here we go. You're going to pay for sitting back there. Someone's going to steal your candy. So, and so that's one. And then there's a bunch of protease inhibitor options that are available now, too, that are our first line. So this is atazanavir, which is Reatas with Norovir that's boosted. There's also Lexiva boosted with Norovir twice a day. So this is nice because it's a once-a-day regimen. There's one pill, and then you have one pill here. So that's three once a day. Atripla is a combination pill, actually, of all these. That's one pill once a day. That's great. And then you have Kaletra, which can be dosed twice a day or once a day for first line. And this is a new kid on the block for first line therapy. This just got approval about a year ago for use at all. But for first line, it's just on this new guidelines. And this is darunavir, which is Prezista, and ritonavir. And I can tell you in the studies done, this actually really, really did well. And it doesn't have the problem that we see with atazanavir and ritonavir, which is a proton pump inhibition problem. And it doesn't have the diarrhea problem that we see with Kaletra, and actually even had, in at least one study, superiority to Kaletra in terms of efficacy. So that really looks like an exciting new drug is Prezista. And we don't see people developing resistance from it if they, for whatever reason, don't suppress on this regimen. So this is alternative regimens. For sake of time, I'm not going to go through these. You know, in terms of, you guys have been on the wards with me, some of you at least, and we've gone over why we pick certain things and how we come to the choice. But this study actually looked at the number of antiretroviral pills prescribed per day and the percent of patients that got to less than 50 copies. And it's a meta-analysis. And the size of the bubbles actually relate to the number of patients that were enrolled in each of these studies combined this meta-analysis. And so what do we see? Of course, the less number of antiretroviral pills per day, more patients actually, here's the percent of patients achieving viral loads less than 50. But there's this trend actually as you get to more pills that actually you're having less people reach that endpoint of less than 50 copies. So less pills actually does better. And also, you know, sometimes you think, you know, hey, if I have HIV and I want to start someone, maybe more would be better. But actually here, at least less pills is better. So, all right, we're going back to our board. And I'm going to throw it over here. And I only know some of your names, so I'm going to throw it to the name I know. Jolina, you get to pick.
I'm okay. You're going to be okay.
For?
I'm okay.
How much? $60. You know, it's not real money. You can... I'm not going to make you pay if you... Okay, recommended steps before initiating HIV therapy. What should we do before we start HIV therapy? Genotype? Okay, all right, that's pretty good. I'll give you that. What else should we do? He wins, okay. What else? Oh, here, Josh won? Okay. Got to give it to Josh. What else do we get? CD4, viral load, okay. I heard that back here, so he wins. Okay, that doesn't win. Hepatitis, that's pretty good. I'll give that. You said that? Okay. All right. Okay. This is what we send. So anybody who's done any kind of rotations in the clinic, you've seen sometimes we have new patients there. So we're going to send a VDRL. I didn't hear anybody say that. We're going to do a PPD. And this is really more, who said that? You're penalized for sitting too far away. All right. All right, send them back. Yeah, get to pay them and send it back. All right. chest x-ray, hepatitis A, B, and C serologies. Toxo is on this list, but I have to tell you, it's almost worthless. Toxo only really helps you when the patient, when you're really truly considering someone has toxo. 95% of those who have toxo will be IgG positive. So there's still some patients that have toxo and they end up being IgG negative. The only way you find that out is that they had a brain biopsy that showed they had toxo and they were IgG negative. This is always important, fasting glucose and lipids. Anybody want to guess why? He's right. Some of these things cause diabetes. Some of these things cause hyperlipidemia. Okay, boy, you're really trying to steal his candy. So GYN exam with pap smear. We do this on all the women. We do it at least once a year. Probably every 6 months is really what we try for. We test the women for chlamydia and gonorrhea. And eye exam for those who have lower CD4s, less than 100. Anybody want to guess why we do it for lower CD4s? CMV retinitis, right, right. I know this is hard to read. You'll have these slides, but this goes through all the stuff. I'm not going to go through all these. After initiating heart, so whenever I'm on the wards, everybody always asks this question: what do we do for after initiating heart? So usually, what we do is we've done our baseline CD4, we've done all our baseline labs, we've done our baseline viral load, and we'll do our follow-up, especially viral load. We'll send off the CD4 too. About 2 to 6 weeks later, and what we're looking for is a one log decrease in the viral load. And that helps tell us that the patient is taking the medicines, absorbing the medicines, and is responding to the medicines. About how far in do we really want to see the viral load starting to edge their way towards the lowest levels of detection? About
6 months.
No, too far.
3 months.
3 months. 3 months is the answer. About 3 to 4 months, you want to see that they're under, you know, under 400 copies or even under 50 copies. And now with even the one I told you about, the new protease inhibitor, in the study looking at that one at 48 weeks, 85% of the patients actually had viral loads less than 50 in that study. Now, anybody want to guess here how many dentists recommend sugarless gum for their patients? 4 out of 5. So we had 85% under 50 at 48 weeks. That's even better than the dentists do with their patients. Okay. Amit, you get the pick. You're sitting in the back. Oh, got a question.
Sorry, do you do that a backup of your testing thing on everyone now?
We don't, because to tell you the truth, the patient, so what Aaron is asking about is hypersensitivity reaction to abacavir. And the ones that you really see it in are white patients, Caucasians. Now, people can have mixed ethnicity and all, but I have to tell you, we rarely see it. It's the recommendation. If you look at the guidelines, they'll tell you to do it in your patients at baseline. But honestly, we see so little hypersensitivity reaction that we don't. But if you really were to do things by the book, you should. There's HLA-B5701 has been associated with this hypersensitivity reaction to abacavir. The test is not that expensive comparatively. It's about $100. So you really should. We don't. You know, or I don't, but so you can criticize me, but you really should. I've never seen a convincing abacavir hypersensitivity reaction in an African-American or Hispanic patient. It's not to say that it doesn't happen. It's just, you know, I haven't seen it. But I really should send it. Okay. Amit, you get the pick. Okay. $80. Situations not calling for resistance testing, not calling for resistance testing. When would you not do a resistance test?
If the viral load is decreasing by one log after 4 weeks.
Okay, that's a pretty good answer. Or, you know, or even better would be the viral load less than 1,000. You can't do it. The test just actually, there's some companies say their test can measure that low, but it's really not a very good test when the viral load is less than 1,000. You probably don't need to do it if the viral load is that low. And there's one other situation when you may not want to do a resistance test, but it's probably not that helpful. Although we still do it sometimes. Anytime.
But if your prevalence of persistence is not,
I thought you were closer. Yeah. What's that? Pan-sensitive. But you'd only know that if you had a resistance test. Yeah, but you never know. I have to tell you, I saw a patient last week, and she told me she hadn't had sex in 9 years, and I really didn't think she was going to be, I thought she was going to have a false positive rapid test, and her Western blot came back positive. So you can never really totally tell. So.
You're not diagnosed
with
the patient.
What? Not exactly. This one's a little tricky, so I'm gonna show you. It's after discontinuation of drugs, and the reason is that probably the resistance test is most accurate. So I don't want to get this one too confusing. You still have some value in doing resistance testing, even for patients for baseline who've never been on medications. You do sometimes see transmitted resistance, and it can be valuable there. But if a patient is off therapy, sometimes, you know, the resistance tests work best in terms of predicting resistance to the medication regimen that someone is on. So if they go off therapy, they may start reverting back to wild type, and it may be too late picking up resistance that developed when they were on therapy. So it's a little bit poorly worded, but probably the best, what they're really getting out of here is the best time to do a resistance test is when the patient's still on therapy or as a baseline. If the viral load's too low, you really can't do it. So that's when you wouldn't do resistance testing. And this just goes when you would do it. So you would want to do it for anybody who has chronic infection and after they start heart and they're not responding to therapy. Pregnant women, so maybe you'll have the urgency to start them on heart, but you want to set the resistance test off when they come in so that you, if you pick up resistance, you're changing the therapy to something that will be more responsive if needed. If they're virologically failing, if they're not suppressing. If they have acute HIV infection, that sometimes is valuable because of, just a flip of what you said, is that if they are infected with a resistance strain, sometimes you can still pick it up. As time goes by, the virus starts reverting to becoming more wild type, and so you may not pick it up. So that's when you would do resistance testing. Okay. All right. Let's pick this side of the room. Margit, you want to go?
Sure. Can't get on the lung for 100.
Okay. That's what I like. And the drug daily double. Woo! These are the most important no-nos to avoid in terms of ARV drug interactions. Name at least two. These are two. There's more than these two examples, but these are two. These are drugs where you don't want to put these together in your regimen. Wait. What? Say it again. Raitaz and PPI. Okay, I'll give you that one. That's okay. All right. Which one? Oh, okay. I won't give you that one so much. But you at least get one. All right. You get one, so. All right. So here we go. Okay. So these are just some examples of when you don't want to put it together. AZT and stavidine, these are both thymidine analogs. We don't use nearly as much of this as we used to. But what happened actually was that in an ACTG trial, one of these big trials, they found that actually patients on this did not have a very good response to therapy. And probably there's some kind of interaction of these two thymidine analogs where you just end up getting very poor drug levels or more metabolism of the drugs and just is just not very, they end up being antagonistic and not really virologically suppressant. You don't want to use abacavir or tenofovir together because what happens here is you select for this really, really bad mutation, K65R, and that happens quickly. And that mutation does is it renders almost all the nucleosides resistant except for AZT. So this is really not such a great regimen. And so I see it every now and then in patients that come in. I'm never really crazy about seeing it. It selects for this really bad mutation, and it happens very, very quickly, like within like the first couple of months that someone's on this regimen. Someone mentioned, and I know a lot of this is fun and games we're talking about, but in terms of practicality for you guys when you're on the wards, this probably, these few slides here, so I'm glad Margit picked this one, these are probably the ones that are really important because these are the ones where I see a lot of times where things should be done differently. And so PPIs should not be given with unboosted atazanavir. So boosted is when you give ritonavir with the atazanavir. But even with ritonavir and atazanavir and PPIs, you have to separate the PPI from it by 12 hours. It really leads to underwhelming, less than suppressive atazanavir levels if the PPI is too close to it. H2 blockers you could use with atazanavir that's boosted. Probably unboosted, don't use H2 blockers either. Probably don't use any antacids. Simvastatin. So simvastatin, you know, unfortunately on a lot of patients who have Medicare Part D, simvastatin is the only statin that's approved. But when they have HIV, simvastatin has drug interactions with the PIs. And the problem, of course, is that the simvastatin levels especially go too high, and then you risk myopathy. Pravastatin can't be used with darunavir for a similar reason. That's the only kind of weird one. Pravastatin usually is okay with all the other protease inhibitors. And if you don't use pravastatin for darunavir, you can use rosuvastatin, which is Crestor or Lipitor. And always go slow, you know, on these statins and go up on them. If you guys ever need, and again, you have all this stuff, these are good websites to check drug-drug interactions. So, okay. It's 5:47, so we've got 13 minutes before we hit Final Jeopardy. Let's see. Somebody whose name I don't know. Who wants to pick? Anybody can yell out. I don't hear anybody buzzing in. I put all these things. My kids right now don't have any of their toys. All right. Anybody? Go ahead. Can we all just get along for 80? Okay, here we go. The tuberculosis drug should not be used with NNRTIs nor PIs. Aaron? And you got the buzzer. You got it clicked in. Which one? Oh, it's rifampin. That's the one. So that's the one. So here we go. So rifamycin, especially rifampin, is the one. If you are going to use one, use rifabutin, and you have to dose adjust it. So rifabutin is a substrate for CYP3A4, and its levels can be affected by PIs and NRTIs. And here's all the dose adjustments. We're not going to go through this for rifabutin if you were to use it with these drugs. So if you really want to use a drug similar in this class, use rifabutin, and these are the dose adjustments. And this is the changes that you see in drug levels. Okay? So we're not going to go through all those, but that's the answer. Okay? All right. Aaron, I guess you get the pick then.
100 for 4.
Okay. The most appropriate management at this time for this patient is a 27-year-old man who comes into the ED following a witnessed tonic-clonic seizure. The patient is alert and oriented. He does not remember having the seizure. He reports that he stumbled more than usual during the past 3 weeks, but is uncertain whether his legs actually feel weak. His HIV was diagnosed 8 years ago. His current meds are AZT, 3TC, and efavirenz, which is combivir and sestiva. 1 month ago, his T-cells were 175. His serologic tests for serum IgG antibodies are Titoxo was negative 6 months ago. He has oral thrush. What? We have an answer. Okay, let's see. He has oral thrush, mild weakness, right lower extremity weakness. CT scan of the brain shows multiple ring-enhancing lesions surrounded by edema.
Go ahead.
Primary B-cell lymphoma. You changing your answer?
Yeah.
Okay.
You already owe $100.
You should have stayed with the first one. So what was the appropriate management? So it's still toxo. Appropriate management, and anybody who knows about, when we've had cases of this, anything with these head lesions, what does the neurosurgeon say? Call me in 2 weeks, give him toxoplasma treatment, right? So we give sulfadiazine, pyrimethamine. We also give folinic acid with this regimen. So CNS mast lesions in HIV patients are most often caused by toxo and then by lymphoma after that. You know, and really usually it's toxos, multiple ring-enhancing lesions. It's a lot of times you see edema. Lymphomas a lot of times presents as a solitary lesion, but there's a lot of overlap. That's not a hard, fast rule. So we do see sometimes toxo is a single lesion and lymphoma is multiple. The patient is very unlikely to have cerebral toxo for three reasons. CD4 is unusually high. This patient isn't, though. His is 175. Toxo happens more like around 100. And I'm just going to show you. Here's a solitary lesion. This was toxo. And CNS mast lesions, patients often are caused by toxo or by lymphoma. That's the point of this one. When diagnosis is uncertain, try to get a biopsy. Okay. Who wants to guess? We have 9 minutes left. Who wants to pick off the board? Anybody? Okay, 80. Here we go. All right. most appropriate management while you're waiting for genotype results. This is a 37-year-old male. He's positive for 3 years. He had diabetes four times 14 years with weakness, myalgias, and frequent headaches. He's never had any symptoms from HIV. At the start of heart, he was on ACT, 3TC, and Kaletra. His T-cells were 143. His viral load is 56,000. He had a normal BUN and creatinine, CBC. His total cholesterol was 249. He has a history of hypertension, hypercholesterolemia. His medications, simvastatin and metoprolol. He's on a step 2 diet. He jogs times 25 minutes 3 times a week. Diffuse muscle tenderness of his extremities.
Stop the statin.
Okay, let's see. And the answer is stop the statin and or change the PI to an NNRTI, Maraviroc, or Raltegravir. I'm going to have to get more candy here. So here we go. So that's exactly it. So much like the other problem that we saw, it's stop the statin or change the PI to an NNRTI, Maraviroc, which is a new drug, or Raltegravir. You could change, you could change the statin to another statin altogether. Yeah, lower dose statin, Crestor or Pravastatin would have been fine also. Okay? Just remembering, you know, who we should treat, who's at risk for cardiac disease, men greater than 45, women greater than 55, and you guys all know this, right? HDL less than 40, diabetes equivalent. Okay? They love outside of HIV, they love to ask this stuff on the boards. They love this whole lipid stuff and who should be treated with statins and who shouldn't, okay? So ACT can cause anemia and myopathy. Tenofovir lacks this problem. Tenofovir, the problem is that it can cause nephrotoxicity. PIs can increase statins and cause myositis. LDL greater than 190 in a patient with diabetes requires treatment. Always be concerned about heart complexity and adherence. Okay. We only have 2 questions left on the board. I'm going to pick. This drug boosts the levels of other antiretrovirals, but it has many drug interactions. What was it? Ritonavir. I hear ritonavir over here. And the answer is ritonavir. So it has pharmacodynamic effects that are good because it actually can boost the drugs. You guys are good catchers. Use of 2 NNRTIs and a PI or NNRTI. I would have to say that ritonavir boosting of protease inhibitors is now the standard. We use very few protease inhibitors without ritonavir anymore. You get much higher drug levels. You get more toxicities associated with that hyperlipidemia. But you get much better viral suppression. And probably there's some forgiveness in that if the patient misses a dose, they probably still have drug levels that are higher than the therapeutic level even for the next day. So ritonavir boosting actually is the way we use most of the protease inhibitors right now. Now, ritonavir is the only boosting agent that we use. There are a couple that are being developed. Maybe they'll actually see the light of day. Maybe they don't. But we'll see. There are other alternatives to ritonavir that are in development. These are, again, drugs that shouldn't be given. Some of these drugs don't even exist anymore, like estemazole, terfenadine, cisapride. But these drugs all have interactions with protease inhibitors. They're all P450 metabolized. They can cause everything from prolonged sedation to QT prolongation. So proton pump inhibitors should not be used with azanavir. That's an important one. Interactions with lipid-lowering agents, simvastatin and lovastatin are contraindicated with PIs or the NNRTI dilavirine. Pravastatin is contraindicated with darunavir. We know we talked about this. Rosuvastatin is a better choice with darunavir. Okay. Last question before our final Jeopardy. I don't have to ask anybody for this one. Greater than 350 and asymptomatic. Greater than 350 asymptomatic. What am I asking here? When should you start heart? And I know this is hard to read, but this is the new answer. What are situations where I can hold off on heart? So if your T cells are higher than 350 or you're asymptomatic, you can hold off on heart. What's the trade-off, though? I have to tell you, the trade-off really is that you have a patient that's viremic and capable of transmitting. And that's something you really have to be concerned about and you have to talk to the patient about, is that if they're not on heart and they have, say, a viral load of 50,000, their T-cells are 500, that if they don't practice safe sex or if they're sharing needles, they can transmit the virus pretty regularly. So you got to really talk to them about it. Studies now are starting to point back to where we were before in terms of hit early, hit hard, in terms of that you see much better responses for those who have higher CD4s, at least higher than 200, than you see when they have lower CD4s. The point is a little bit moot for us because here when we do testing at Jacobi, a lot of our patients are showing up with, at least half of them are showing up with CD4s of less than 250. So we're still missing a lot of the folks. And so it really leads the way to the last question. I talked about this already. So let me just go down. All right, this is our last question. Final Jeopardy. Here we go. Final Jeopardy. And the question is, we're all in this together. Something you can do for all your patients that can make a huge difference. Oh, what? What's HIV test? Man, this guy's cleaning up. I had to get a whole bag of candy for him. Was adhere to the 2006 CDC recommendations for HIV screening. Does anybody know what the HIV recommendations were in 2006? Who did they say we should test? You got to share with everybody else. Who did they say we should test?
16 to 65.
Pretty close, 13 to 64. Yeah, we should test. If you test older, that's okay. The oral test is approved only for 13 and above. It's not to say that it doesn't work for younger kids, but that's who it's approved for. This is the phone numbers. Guys, if you call these numbers, a counselor will come up and test the patients. Either of these numbers, okay? This is the recommendations. The CDC changed a little bit. In New York, we still have written consent that's required, pre- and post-test counseling that's required. Now, for a doc, pre- and post-test counseling can be very streamlined. It can be basically talk to the patient about what an HIV test is, what it can do, what it can't do, what the results will mean. If it's a preliminary test, it's going to be positive. It's pretty simple. It's kind of bulleted points on that consent form. And then it's assigned consent. You can do the oral test. Some folks prefer the blood test, but they're both very sensitive and specific, like over 99%. And if those are positive, we'll send a Western blot for confirmation. And here we send expedited Western blot, so it's about 2 to 3 days. We link them right away to care. So you guys see that in the sense that they'll be admitted to the ACS team or to another team and flow over. But most of the patients need to be admitted, and we can't take them right over to the clinic. So I know this is very obvious to this whole group, and then I talk about this stuff. But still, offer it to all your patients in clinic, on the floors. If you need someone to go test them, those are the numbers, 5211-6997. They'll come up and do it. They're supposed to do it. Dr. Goring just came in and out, but she's our inpatient attending for HIV testing. And she knows, she'll help you work through this. You can call her, call me, whatever. The CDC said, we hear all these complaints about docs that it's that counseling is an issue. So they said, you know what? If that's going to be a barrier, get rid of the counseling. And doc said, well, it's the consent's a problem. So the CDC said, well, that's a problem. Let's get rid of the consent process. We haven't. New York State hasn't yet. Maybe it will. There's some movement afoot to try to change how these things are. But even without all that stuff, I can tell you that here at Jacobi, doing the emergency room testing, 75% of all the folks that we approach agree to get tested. So the patients are interested and want to. We always worry about that 25% that don't, especially when they end up on inpatient service. So when you're on your service or whatever, I'm going to try to see if I can make it around the wards, get your attendings to at least talk about offering it. Just offer it to people. So, why is this important? Because 25% of all those that don't know their diagnosis account for at least half of the new infections. At least half of the new infections. And if we look actually now, there's more people alive with HIV than ever before, which is much better. I mean, we had people dying before. The number of AIDS cases has gone down. But with all these folks that are alive with HIV, that means there's more folks that if they're not having viral loads that are suppressed, if they're not practicing safe sex, or if they are sharing needles, those are all folks that can transmit the virus. If we look at New York City, we have the highest AIDS case rate in the U.S., and if we look at the Bronx, we're among the worst in all of New York City. So we have among the worst AIDS death rates. So we have a lot of it here, too. What providers can do, ensure routine offering of voluntary testing, all patients seen in the ED, all the patients seen on the floors, in your ambulatory care clinic. I know this is very obvious to you guys, but I got a call on Monday that was really disturbing on GYN. And what did they call me about? They had a woman who they wanted to discharge. It was 5 o'clock at night. She had vulvar cancer. She had a preliminary positive HIV test, and they wanted to know what the next steps were. And so in the process, I asked them, I said, well, and they were calling one of the counselors to come up and tell her the results, although they had done the testing. Well, that's not right. I mean, it's like you guys testing somebody on the floor for tuberculosis and then calling in a different team to tell them the results. I mean, that's not how you become a doctor, right? You do a test, you tell the person the result. The other important thing, though, is that we shouldn't be waiting for people to have presenting illness when we have treatment, really treatment that will make a huge difference in terms of survival. So we should be offering this to all folks. We should be trying to get them tested and try to get them into care much earlier so that we don't have these terrible outcomes. Oh, I got a call. Okay. This is what the United States looks like in terms of HIV for 15 to 49-year-olds. There are about 800,000 people who are positive living with HIV or AIDS. There's about 480,000 that are eligible for HEART, meaning that their T-cells are less than 350. There's about 340,000 that are in care. There's about 268,000 that actually are on antiretrovirals. And of those on antiretrovirals, it's 176,000 that actually are on what's considered highly active antiretroviral therapy. So if we look at actually who should be on therapy, it's about 500,000, and we actually have 175,000 that are on truly active antiretroviral therapy. And when you think about this, why? Well, not everybody's engaged in care. We have people that are positive, don't know it, and maybe have lower CD4s. But also we have a lot of folks that are in corrections, a lot of folks that are homeless, a lot of folks that are mentally ill who just are not engaged in care or don't have the providers with knowledgeable about HIV treatment to their disposal. Know your status, get tested for HIV, reduce risky behaviors, use condoms to protect yourself and others. Even the American College of OBGYN says we should be routinely offering HIV testing to 19 to 64. I shouldn't say even, but they recommend it too. So when I got that call on Monday, it really didn't put me in a good frame of mind. HIV testing should be part of a routine physical. The Medical Society of the State of New York says they're petitioning New York State to change the laws, consider HIV testing for everybody. And recommendations for HIV screening. When evaluating patients, physicians should routinely consider the possibility of HIV and really offer it. I mean, we have the service. All I'm asking is that you guys talk to your patients about it, call the phone number for the counselors to come by and do the testing. And if there's any problems with them coming up and doing what you need, you just call me or call Dr. Goring, okay? That's it. That's all I have. I have a lot of candy here, though. Anybody want? You got to share, though.
I got a whole one.